Should I pull a Jade and start recording right now?
Yeah, hold on. Let me get my mic in. Make sure we got the right mic on. This thing has seen better days. There it is.
Well, when you talk into it so much and with such hot takes, it just starts to kind of melt away.
Yeah, the USB connector is actually warped.
Yeah, I actually had the same thing happen, and then I had to go to Radio Shack and buy a new one for $20, yeah, which made me so angry that I spent any money at Radio Shack, not to mention $20 for a simple like USB cord.
A couple things. First of all, I'm surprised Radio Shack is still open. I haven't seen
one. It was hard finding one. It was hard finding one. Like, three of the ones that I looked up initially had closed.
But the other thing is that, like, a long, long, long time ago, I used to work in a computer store. And that's when I discovered USB cables and Ethernet cables cost literally less than a buck.
Of course they do.
And like the markup is just, this is just to keep the lights on right now.
Well, yeah, my favorite thing is like those monster cables that are like $75 and like gold plated and all that. And they actually had a purpose back when it was like, you know, the AV, like actual like cable, like just going right into the back of your TV. But now that it's HDMI, there's like literally no difference when it's being transmitted digitally between these like, you know, $100 cables and the cheapest possible one that you can buy.
Pretty much.
It's great.
Pretty much, yeah.
So you got anything you want to talk about here? Because you don't have enough audiovisual platforms already to express your opinion.
I don't know. No one's asked me for my opinion in quite a while, so believe it or not. So I'm open to anything right now.
Well, so let's see. What was the first thing I want to talk about? I am going to start it with this, by the way. So I wrote a piece for The Cauldron that's going to go up tomorrow on some of the surprising starts and whether they're sustainable and whether I need to eat crow because I was wrong and all that good stuff. So I want to kind of go through some of these surprising teams. Hey, and
It begins with Porzingis. I'm going to hold this. You're right on a lot of things. You were not high on Porzingis at Summer League. I sat next to you. We watched him. And you're like, I don't know. And I was like, this guy's going to be great. And
I don't remember you saying that.
I was very optimistic about him.
All right. Well, so let me clarify what my stance was on Porzingis, because everyone seems to be thinking that I was.
You didn't say thought
he was just going to be a huge bust or something. I didn't say that.
You said, correct me if I'm wrong. You said you think he isn't laterally quick enough to be a 4, so he has to be a 5. And at the outset of his career right now, because he's too skinny to play 5, it was going to be one of those things where too slow to play 4, too skinny to play 5. And my thing was, I don't think he's slow at all. I think he's actually pretty good.
Thank you. That was much more efficient than me simply stating what my own opinion was. that's part of it, but I didn't think like, oh, he shouldn't have been. I thought like he should have been drafted kind of like 6 to 9 range instead of 4. I thought that Moutier would have been a better choice. He's obviously has been better than Moutier. I don't know if I still buy that he has more potential. But yeah, obviously like he's been a lot better than I would have anticipated so far. I certainly will acknowledge that. But so, I mean, what is he doing that, and is it sustainable what he is doing? Because he's not, you would think his best thing would be shooting. He's not even shooting that well right now. He's just holding up better in some of the other aspects, which I don't think I expected. Maybe you did.
You know, Nate, one of the things that people, when we go to Summer League, we watch Summer League and say, it's Summer League, it doesn't matter. But there are things that you can see and learn about a player that I think totally matter. And for me, the lasting thing, I don't know what his stats were at Summer League without looking them up. I don't know whether they were gaudy or not, but I remember one thing clearly. This dude ran to set picks, multiple picks and possessions, and then when he set them and released, he ran to the rim. He sets hard and he rolls hard. And I said, you know what? It sounds like such a simple, easy thing to do. There's only a percentage of bigs in this league who actually do that. Most of them treat it like it's a chore. Oh, got to set the screen.
Yeah, they do the David Lee, Carlos Boozer.
I'm going to linger.
I'm rolling for my own offense. I don't even care about making contact with the defense.
Right, and
why do coaches let guys get away with that?
I don't know. I think we talk about it, and then you get in the game, and there's just so many other things that are happening. It's one of those things that's very apparent on film, though. You go back and you look at it, and, you know, we talked about this with Dwight Howard with the Lakers, We talked about it. I know I've talked about it with Hassan Whiteside with the Heat. You know, you first of all, like you just pointed out, it's not because you're going to get the ball, but it's because A, the contact is going to free your man up for just the split second that most NBA athletes need, and B, you rolling to the rim hard forces everybody to react. The defense has to respect that unless you're Joel Anthony, and we know they're not going to pass you the ball. But if you're a average skilled big, the defense has to react to that stimulus. Otherwise, there's a guy who's rolling to the rim unfettered who's going to probably finish at a very high rate. And so when I saw that for him as a 19-year-old kid in summer league where the guards never passed the ball and he didn't lose any hope or didn't look dejected after a while like Jonas Valanciunas kind of does/did in Toronto. There were a lot of times he would pick and roll and no one would look for him and he was just kind of like, why am I doing this? Porzingis never exhibited that. And for me, I was like, you know what? Just off of sheer length and athleticism doing that, he's going to be somewhat effective. And, you know, and now watching him play, you know, it's that, dare I say, it's almost Pollyannic optimism that he has, that he's had since the day he was drafted. That makes
but he has crazy eyes, though. I mean, didn't you notice that? Didn't you? Wasn't that the first thing you did at Summer League was take some binoculars and try to see if you could look at his eyes from the stand to see whether they're crazy? Who?
Somebody said,
that
I remember
thing?
That. I remember some.
Oh, it was Dan Dockich.
Dockich. You can look in his eyes and know it's not quite there. Yeah. No. Sadly.
Crazy eyes. What a ridiculous statement. Anyway, I digress there. But yeah, I thought his ability, he was pretty good when he was playing for Sevilla on pick and roll as well, and he's his hands are okay. He's pretty good. I mean, but he hasn't really been used in pick and roll that much either. And I think, you know, the triangle, it's fine for like getting him some mid range jumpers, but I think his potential actually is being wasted in the triangle as a guy who can pick and pop for three. They haven't been running hardly any of that at all. And also as a guy who can mix it up and go to the rim, too. I mean, I think when guys can do both of those things, it's such a weapon, but we're just, you know, it's not really something that the triangle does pretty much uniquely among NBA teams.
No, it's funny. They're using him like a garbage man, right? He's rich man's AC Green right now. Just go grab crash boards and the like, and we'll get you some stuff. But again, I go back to that. His ability to still have an impact and not feel dejected at all about his role. I like it. I like what I see in him. You know, obviously with his length and his athleticism, he's always going to be a force on the glass. But you're right. This is scratching the surface of the things that he can do. And I just want to go back to when we talk about the triangle, there's pick and rolls in the triangle. It's just you have to count on your players to reach those progressions. And a lot of sometimes what happens with the Knicks, I'm not trying to let Derek Fisher off the hook here, but a lot of it is just because the players aren't that good. They're better than last year, but they're still not that good as far as being able to understand fully the offense and go through all the things that are available to you within it.
Yeah, they're 3-4 right now. Do you think they can continue to win at that pace throughout the entire year? Or is it going to regress?
I had them as optimistically a 38-win team. That's like the everything goes right. Nobody gets hurt. Nobody starts pouting.
Right, so that wasn't your prediction. That was this is the absolute ceiling.
Yes, this is the ceiling for them. And so 3-4 would indicate that they're headed somewhere around that area. Again, I mean,
they haven't played anyone yet, right? I mean, who's the best team they
played?
Cleveland. The
they played Cleveland. They lost, but.
Oh yeah, they lost in competitive fashion.
Yeah, you know, it was one of the rare times I've ever seen like unanimous from the media, from the fans, from the team. Like they lost that game. And I was like, that's a good game, and I was like, whoa, what happened here? Usually someone's calling for somebody's head. Like I can't believe we lost that game. You blew it. And that was the one time everyone was kind of like, you know what? Maybe this thing isn't so bad. So kudos.
Well, it's so much easier to be okay with the team not winning games when you have even just one bright spot. And Grant actually has been pretty decent for them too so far. But when you have just some youth, some reason for optimism that you think there's part of a plan here that we're moving towards something, and they haven't had that. I mean, when I did the Knicks preview podcast, their last like good draftee basically was Patrick Ewing, right?
No. I'm going to stop you there. The last good
draftee. Well, or that actually stuck around and played for them for a while.
I would go with Trevor Ariza. I would. I was with the.
Oh yeah, Isaiah actually had like, a pretty good.
Wilson
run.
Chandler was good. David Lee.
Oh yeah, Gallo.
Gallo was a good pick. The last time I've seen this kind of optimism was Trevor Ariza. Because the team had been struggling for those couple of years, and then Ariza came in. He was a second-round pick, and nobody really expected much. He was also 19 years old, and he didn't play much at UCLA, so it was like there was an element of, who is this kid? Why are the Knicks taking him so high in the second round? And then he started playing, and they're like, oh, he's pretty good. And then it reached a point, I'm going to say around December, January, maybe a little later in the year, but it reached a point where anything Ariza did was just grounds for, like, this guy's the greatest rookie ever.
Did they dump him in the Steve Francis?
They sure did. They sure did. That was Larry Brown. They called him delusional, which he was right. That's the crazy thing is that on some level he was right. That doesn't mean you trade him for Steve Francis when you already have Stephon Marbury. But Steve Francis and Anthony Hardaway, right? Was Penny in that?
Penny might have been like amnestied or something by that point.
Yeah, no, I'm getting mixed up. Penny came with Stephon.
Yeah, that's right. But then they were going to recreate Isaiah Thomas and Joe Dumars.
No. It was Walt Frazier and Earl the Pearl. They said that in the
press conference.
But anyway, going back to Ariza. Ariza was good because, like Porzingis now, he wasn't asked to do much, just the things that kind of would come naturally to him. And he did a good job. And then the Knicks season started to spiral out of control that year. I don't know if you remember, they were like hovering around 500.
That was the Larry Brown year, right?
No, this is the year before Larry Brown.
Okay.
This was Lenny? I think it was Lenny. But they were 500, hovering around 500 around New Year's. And then that was the year the Suns got off to the great start. And someone asked Stephon Marbury, you keep saying you're the best point guard in the league, but Steve Nash basically took the same roster you had, and then 31-4, whatever they are. Do you still feel that way? And Stephon said, last time I checked, you know, I looked at my paycheck and I looked at his. I'm getting max, he's not. So obviously I'm doing something right. And then that's when the season nosedived. And as it nosedives, there's more and more emphasis on, well, at least Ariza's playing well. And then it turned into like, Ariza ties the shoelaces. Oh my God, did you see the way he looped and swooped with that one? That was incredible. And
I could totally see Frazier saying that, looping and swooping as he's tying his shoes.
Everybody went crazy. And then it went to Ariza's head. And then he went through this little phase in life where he thought, like, I'm much better than being a 3-and-D guy. Even when he was in it. That's why he left the Lakers eventually, is because, like, I'm better than just guarding people and hitting corner threes. He went to the Rockets to go be an all-star for the same amount of money and ended up realizing that you are nowhere near that. But that's a long way of saying, you know, as the season goes up and down, I believe Porzingis' hype will continue to grow.
So, yeah, a couple things about Porzingis, and these actually might seem somewhat contradictory. I mean, you said that he's kind of been a garbage man. He actually has a 25% usage rate right now, and that's actually the same as it was when he was playing for Sevilla. So actually, I mean, although he's not being asked to create offense, he's getting, you know, a fair amount of shot attempts, some of those on the offensive glass. But then the biggest limitation I still see for him is I don't necessarily see him as a one-on-one offense creator, even at his peak. But, you know, he's surprised so far in some of the other aspects, and I think especially if he does turn into that stretch five, type of guy who, you know, with his 7'6" wingspan can block a bunch of shots too. I think he could be a very revolutionary player and, you know, a guy who could be the second best player on a good team someday for sure.
Absolutely. I think he's that guy. And again, I'm not comparing his game, but more his role. He can be someone like Scottie Pippen because he can do all the things that you need someone to do, but at a high level while someone else presumably carries the burden of the offensive focus. In another life, you know, if you were a little older, if Melo maybe were a little younger, they would be a great tandem, right, as a 4-5.
Yeah, that's true. It would be fantastic, but yeah, and so we'll see what happens with Melo. So let's get some of these other surprising teams here. Detroit, what do you think? And you know I'm going to have to ask you about the Pelicans too, yeah. But I'll save that.
That's the last one
for later.
That's the last.
Yeah, I'll save that for my other Amin may have to eat crow topic. But yeah, so the Pistons 5-1, Drummond has been unbelievable. What do you how much of what they're doing can last throughout the year?
I don't think they're going to be a 50-win team, if that's what you're asking, but I think they're going to be a good team this year, and good meaning playoff. Excuse me.
Does Jay, like, just edit those
no, I'm,
out?
No, I've
what?
Been
or,
sick or for the last week. I went to New York last weekend, and or, you know, a week ago, and I came back with something, and now, hold on, I'm going to try. I got the mute button here, so let me. They're going to be a little pauses here and there.
That's all right. We're not. This is not totally overproduced like some certain other shows are.
Wacky.
Some might even say we are slightly underproduced.
I would like to say just right. It's just the right amount of production. No, Stan has this team this year is built in Stan's image, right? This is how he wanted to play, and the roster he inherited last year was not capable of doing that. And mainly because of Josh Smith and Greg Monroe, and by pulling four guys on the perimeter and just having Drummond be the guy, the sole guy in the paint or the sole pick setter, it works. It speaks to their core competencies. Now, here's the thing, and I had the pleasure of watching them play in person on Friday. They played the Suns against disorganized teams. What I mean are teams that don't have a great attention to detail. So not Atlanta, not the Spurs, not Golden State, not the great teams, I guess what I'm saying. They're going to get away with, they don't even have to play well every night. You know, and I don't think the Suns are a bad team, but I don't think they're a very organized team. I don't think attention to detail and things like that when I think about the Suns. And so the Pistons are going to get away with ugly wins on nights like that. But when they play the better teams, I think that's when they're going to get put in their place a little bit, the better executing teams. But as far as playing in the East, obviously you're not seeing a lot of those teams on a nightly basis. So, yeah, I'm all in on the Pistons bandwagon.
You know, Drummond has been so effective, and this is something that's occurred to me, is that it seems like a lot of times, and this happened with Tristan Thompson in the playoffs too, when he was started just killing it on the offensive glass, and you know, offensive rebounding has been kind of de-emphasized lately, and maybe that makes the guys who can do it sort of as a one-man band even more valuable. But it seems like when guys start getting killed on the offensive glass, they would almost rather just let a guard have a layup than give up an offensive rebound.
Right. Well, I mean,
because as a big guy, that's like, you know, just sort of that's the ultimate stain that you can't protect the defensive glass. Like, oh, come on, box out. Like,
right.
You know,
well, I mean,
so they just let guys go in for layups. So Reggie Jackson is just doing that all the time on pick and rolls now because the big is just terrified of Drummond.
That goes back to the paradox of defense, right? Is that it's all for one for all. We have to play on a string, da da da. But then when someone scores, whose fault was that? And when you see someone had 8 offensive rebounds, they're not going to say that was because my big had to come out and show on the penetration, and then the weak side guard or whoever, wing or whatever, did not crack back. And no one says that. They say, oh, my God, you gave up 8 offensive rebounds. And that's the thing for big guys. I always tell this to our young bigs. As a big man, rightly or wrongly, you're going to be judged on 2 things. You're going to be judged on protecting the defensive glass, and you're going to be judged on your field goal percentage. So, you know, I told this to Markieff Morris. I said, if you're shooting 40% and you average 7 rebounds a game, it doesn't matter. Like, all that other stuff doesn't matter. You are going to look bad by default. And so, you know, that's the thing, but you're right.
Well, can I stop you right there?
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that to him. You know,
It was actually after a night of particularly horrendous shot selection is why I said it. But those are the 2 things they're judging.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so I mean, it does occur to me, though, that a lot of times this is the media maybe more than teams, but the things that the traditional media judges guys on aren't necessarily things that win basketball games, right? Or even that back in the day got things paid.
Right.
And part of the reason I think we just are seeing better basketball now in the NBA is because of the fact that the guys who actually do small things to win, that we're actually like better at measuring that
right
now. Like Damari Carroll can get close to a max contract. Chris Middleton can get close to a max contract now because people actually realize and will pay for the things that get you to win instead of just like points and rebounds with no regard for efficiency or defense or anything else.
Right. Draymond Green being probably the shining example of this, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's another one. He's 19 in NBA rank. I couldn't believe that he was that high.
And on some level, there might be some inflation on the other side, but you're right in that we are doing a better job of recognizing what helps people win. But at the same time, I do think that, you know, flip side, Enes Kanter got $70 million. Even though it's the worst kept secret in the league, right? We know. I'm not just saying like from fans or media standpoint. Every NBA team knows this guy is instant death defensively, right? This isn't a secret. It's not an opinion. This is as close to fact as you can get. This guy is the worst defensive big in the league, and he got a $70 million offer sheet, and then his team matched on it. So, on some level, as much as we want to say those days are over, they're still very much here, and so people are getting judged on these things all the time. And when you talk about going back to Andre Drummond and his threat on the offensive glass, that guy knows, the guy who's guarding him knows that, look, I may go over here and force a miss, but the percentage that Andre Drummond rebounds the ball at is so great on the offensive end that it's just maybe it's just worth it for my guard to look bad. You got blown by. Keep your man in front of you, right? And that's the same thing when we talk about bigs with foul trouble. Who was it we were talking about the other day?
Whiteside,
yes. Whiteside. The idea that he picks and chooses when he's going to contest. Well, at some point you have to, right? Because if you contest everything and your guards can't keep guys in front of them, you're the one who's going to get saddled with early foul trouble. Not them. They're the one that can guard them. Have at it, you know. So it's a lot.
Yeah, and he's in a contract year. He hasn't made any money at all. Mm-hmm. If he's sitting on the bench in these games, he can't put up the numbers that he probably thinks that he needs to. And he also seems to have the sort of personality where he might be a little more focused on certain statistics than you might think.
That's what makes basketball great, right? That's why they used to always compare it to jazz. At least they used it, like when I was growing up. They always say basketball is like jazz in the sense that it's improvisational, but there is a method to the madness, and it's an individual, but you still have to fit into the collective. And it's balancing those two acts of doing my own thing, but still working towards the common goal. How do we do all that? And, you know, that's what makes it great, right?
All right. So because we have a tendency to ramble, which I certainly enjoy, of course, I did want to make absolutely sure that we talked about the Pelicans.
No, that's the last one. You're supposed to save that to the end.
Well, I don't know. I mean, in case like you hack up a lung or something like in the interim, I just want to make sure we like got this out of the way. What's going on with them? They've had some injury problems. AD is getting it back on track the last couple of games, but they're still 0-6. You and I both thought that Gentry and Darren Erman would be a coaching upgrade. What do you see with them, and how do they turn it around?
Well, I see two things. One is obvious, and one is not so obvious. The obvious is injuries, right? They're hurt, and now Ethan will argue, well, you should have factored that in because they have a history of getting hurt down there.
Yeah, and I did. I did when I said they're going to be under 47 wins, but I didn't think they're going to be 0-6 either.
I'll be honest, I didn't quite grasp the gravity of the situation until I found out that they hired their trainer from the football team, and I was like, okay, never mind, never, silly me for you know thinking they'd get things right. So that's huge, and I think, I mean, it goes without saying, look, anytime Ish Smith has to play 30 plus minutes, something has gone awfully wrong, and it's to hold anyone accountable when they're playing Ish Smith 30 plus minutes, and he's a fine young player, and he's a nice guy to have in your locker room, and he's a good third string backup, and even 10 to 12 minutes a night is fine, but 30 plus minutes, huge red flag. The not so obvious, and this is the thing that maybe I glossed over, and I wish I hadn't, was I never considered for a second that maybe the team wouldn't buy in immediately to what these guys are preaching them. Because I'm like, oh, these guys come with great reputations with his Alvin, with his Darren Erman, with his Phil Weber, Robert Pack, a former player. I mean, this is a solid staff. And yet,
yeah, they loved Monty though.
They loved Monty. Yeah, because I thought same thing. You know, a lot of the Warriors love Mark Jackson, but Steve Kerr comes in with some ideas that are pretty good, and everyone's like, yeah, that sounds a lot better than ISOing all the time, and everyone kind of bought in. And that's the thing I'm seeing from this is just from the outside looking in. I'm watching them play. I'm watching Drew Holiday walk the ball up the floor where Alvin is screaming at him, pick up the pace, because people confuse 7 seconds or less basketball to mean, oh, we're going to fast break every single time. No. The idea was in our half court, it would be with tempo. So I'm not going to walk into this pick and roll. I'm going to run into this pick and roll. And as a ball handler, I'm going to attack aggressively, and I'm going to bring the ball up with pace.
And Steve Nash and Steph does this now too. When you get the inbound, you are already jogging back down floor. You're getting the inbound on the move, even after you give up a make.
Right. Not the traditional.
Every point guard in the league should do that, by the way.
It's not the traditional.
And only Nash and Steph are the only ones that I ever see do that.
Let me think who else. Somebody else does it. I'm trying to think who. It'll come to me. But yeah, you're right. It is a lot. The traditional point guard thing is to stand there like a free throw line extended or whatever and have your hands out like you're a quarterback accepting the hike. And that's not how you play this style. Similarly, the guys, the wings, when you come down court, you don't stroll. You have to be ahead of the ball, and you got to be deep corners to begin with, and then you start whatever action you go through, whether it's cutting across the baseline, whether it's coming up on the three-point line, whether it's coming to set a basket, whatever it is, you start in the corners. When the ball crosses half court, you should be already in the corners, because that's the whole premise is we're going to space this thing out. And the defense is going to have to make some hard decisions whether I'm going to help on this guy or help on that guy. And anytime you walk, anytime you do this slowly, you just make life easier for the defense. So there's a lot of that going on in New Orleans in the early going. And I don't know if that's, again, resistance or just a bad habit that's hard to break. But that's something I didn't anticipate. I just thought that they would buy in because I also think they're smart guys. Now, again, you got to say, well, if Tyreke Evans is there, does that change things? Because now he's the one who's bringing the ball up. He's the one that's playmaking. And now Drew just has to get to the corner as opposed to bring the ball up in his slow, methodical way.
Yeah, and it's
Ty Lawson.
Interesting
Ty Lawson
to note, too, like Drew started under
Doug
Collins, right, who has always like been one of the slowest paced guys in the league. Even when he was back with the Bulls and he was coaching Michael Jordan, he had one of the slowest paced teams in the league. But you haven't mentioned a single thing about their biggest problem yet, and that's that they are last in the league in defense, 3.5 points per 100 possessions worse than the Lakers.
They're terrible. And more than anything, they just don't look organized, right? It's over rotation, under rotation. It's just nothing. Nothing consistent, right? This is what Alvin used to always preach. We're going to do it this way. If it doesn't work, we did it this way and it doesn't work, that's my fault. But if you guys never do what I asked you to do, then we don't know whether it works or not, or whether it's your fault, whether it's my fault. And the thing that, again, watching them play, there's no consistency. They guard and pick and roll is different every single time down the floor. You got guys, again, jumping and leaving guys wide open, or you got nobody reacting and people getting wide open layups, and that has to stop. Now, I don't know if they need to simplify their defense because guys don't understand it, and again, that will come as a surprise to me. You talk about Ashik, when you talk about, I know he's been hurt, but he's back now. You talk about Anthony Davis, you talk about Drew Holiday. These are not dumb players. It's not we're talking about Enes Kanter and, you know, Swaggy P. These are fairly bright, high IQ players, and for them to not get it, or at least not do it. Again, now, is it them trying to think like, this is better, I'll do it better this way? Regardless, those are concerning things.
You want to guess who has the best net rating on the Pelicans right now, the only one who is positive?
Don't say Ish Smith.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, come on.
But you know what, though? I think, and I don't know whether Drew kind of didn't really have a chance to condition as much this offseason because of that stress reaction, you would think that he might have. But Ish is really, I think, the only point guard they have, the only perimeter guy at all, really, who has been playing any defense. AD just has not looked good defensively either. I feel like there are just so many times when guys drive by him and he just doesn't react or he doesn't even jump at all. Like he is, they haven't really been any better overall than they have been just overall. So, you know, it's not like it's the depth
right.
that's killing them. I mean, you know, Davis and Anderson are two, that unit should be killing people. And those guys are both, you know, in the red by over 10 points per 100 possessions so far.
Right. No, I mean, it's again, I think that's and that goes back to that second less obvious thing is that they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. And probably I should probably stop talking there because I don't know anymore whether that's them refusing to do it, them not knowing how to do it. Them, but whatever it is, they're not executing. And that's a bigger issue right now than probably even the depth.
So you think it's more that they're just executing the scheme incorrectly as opposed to lack of effort?
On defense?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the effort is definitely part of it, but you tell me what the scheme is. You watch them play, like, you can't tell because they're just doing whatever they want now. Maybe there's mental effort I'm alluding to there. But, you know, I think about a guy like Manimal. What's his name? Kenneth Faried. That's the shining example of effort, but I have no idea what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And you can see it, and that's why he's not a good defensive player, not as good as he should be. And now take that and take away the extraordinary effort, at least physical effort, and that you got the New Orleans Pelicans on defense.
So another team that is I've been very impressed with their defensive effort is the Cavs so far. And I watched their game yesterday against the Pacers. I actually thought Kevin Love was totally fine. I think he's been totally fine this year. Do you agree with that? Do you think that he at times was unfairly maligned? I thought he was terrible at the start of last year. I think we both said that. But is it possible that he could actually like be okay and that they could defend at a top 10 level even though he's getting major minutes for them?
Yeah, because it's not up to him, right? Not him alone. Not as long as you have competent, you know, people out there with them, and they've done that. You know, he's a great rebounder. He's a smart player. He should be at least be able to send the guy he can't guard in the right direction, right? I think we can agree he can do that. And really, NBA defense, a lot of times, that's what it comes down to, you know, is can I'm not saying the extreme is, oh, just go right by me. And that's what gets bigs in foul trouble because they have no time to react. But if you can just like, okay, I know you're going to get by me, but just take that one extra dribble or take that angle a couple of degrees wider than you really want it to. So it's not straight line penetration. We can do something now because at least they know, okay, if he's going to get beat, it's coming from over there. It's not going to be a free for all of I got to, you know, put too many fingers in the holes in the dam. And then obviously he's a great rebounder and he's a great outlet passer. And so that's pretty important in terms of, you know, every defensive stop ends with the possession and then flipping that possession into offense quickly. Last year he started the year slowly. But as the year went on, to me, it was more and more apparent that this is a guy who is not being used correctly. And what ends up happening with a lot of players is when I'm not used correctly offensively, defensively, I'm not going to be that great either. And I know we can sit here and moralize, like, you should always, but that's not how it works. Particularly with gifted players.
I mean, everybody who's played pickup has done that, right? Someone on your team takes a bad shot, and you don't get back on defense because you're just kind of annoyed and demoralized. Yeah. I mean, and that's just a natural human reaction that the best players and the best role players are able to kind of tune out, but it is something that happens for sure.
Right, and I would even say the best players can tune it out. Even if it happens to the best players. They don't get the ball. They start with Shaq. You know,
as an aside, by the way, I almost never get back on defense when we're playing together on the same team.
Oh, man, that's because we're too busy scoring. We're getting buckets. You don't need to get back when you get buckets.
I don't know. We need a little revenge against Seth Partno at Sloan this year.
He
lit us up last year.
The next game we played him, I locked him down, though, man, because I said, you know, okay, I get the value proposition here. You're going to shoot every time. Like, that's a hard thing. Sometimes, like, people you see on Twitter all the time, but you have no idea how they play. The same thing with Zach. Have you ever played with Zach Harper?
No, I haven't, but I've heard that he he will fire away.
Yeah, like Zach Harper can play, but it took me a while to figure out, oh no, he's going to shoot every time. And then like, oh, okay, now I get it. But until you get it, like sometimes you're, all right, he's coming. He's probably going to make this pass. Nope. No, he's not.
I mean, you just got to follow the scouting report.
Pretty much,
that's it.
Pretty much.
What were we talking about anyway? Oh, yeah. So, yeah, Kevin Love, yesterday, like, he got stuck in isolation against George Hill a couple of times and actually, like, slid with him and stopped him. I was pretty shocked to see that. So, I, you know, and he's actually, I think I looked at his numbers against isolations, and he's only given up, like, 11 points on, like, 19 isolations or something like that, which is excellent. Even isolations are low value, but that's even, you know, pretty good. And you assume pretty much any time he's being isolated against, it's probably a guard on a switch. And that's obviously, you know, it's only 19 possessions. But in watching those, he actually performed pretty well, which I was surprised by. So maybe the Cavaliers could keep the defense going. I mean, I thought they were really going to struggle out of the gate with all the injury problems. And they kind of haven't, even though it's been a soft schedule.
Because, again, it goes back to, I don't have to, you know, it doesn't have to lock you down. I don't have to be a straitjacket. But can I do enough in conjunction with the guys behind me, right? So, again, switched against George Hill. I didn't see the possession, but I'm just thinking, just move enough where George Hill isn't taking a straight line to the basket. And then, so he knows that if I take any wider angle or any extra dribble, the help defense behind him is now loaded in, and now I can't even get to the front of the rim, even if I do get by him. And so now I have to take this pull-up jumper. Dude, that's all it takes right there. I know it's easier said than done, but you know, a lot of times for me, I always go back to, if you're giving me the choice between a guy who's smart but slow versus a guy who's really quick and athletic but dumb as a box of rocks, I'm going to take the smart guy, because at least I can build a defensive scheme around this, around the idea that you can't react. You're not going to be able to react quick enough to stop him, but you can maybe slow him down just a second so that the rest of us can get into place.
Yeah, we can call that like the Nick Collison corollary, right, or something like that. All right, so this is the next thing I want to get to. Are you ready to acknowledge that Steph Curry is playing better than Steve Nash ever did?
Well, now he is. Yeah, sure. now he's playing
better. But as of like March 1st of 2015, you did not agree.
I think the thing when it comes to Steve, again, it goes back to being able to measure things that are immeasurable. And Steve, it goes beyond assists. It goes beyond leading the league in offensive rating for 8 straight years, even though he changed teams and rosters a lot in that time. It was about making guys greater than the greatest version of themselves. And then that aspect, Steph still, he's a great playmaker. He doesn't make people greater than the greatest version of themselves. And he doesn't need to, because he's on a great team, and the way they play is perfect. Let me just make that straight. I'm not sitting here like, oh, Steph could be doing so much more. But yeah. I think the value of Steve Nash was this kind of hippie, touchy-feely, kind of hard to measure, hard to grasp thing, but it was something that made everybody better than what they should have been. And that's special and different. And I think of 3 players. Honestly, and I don't want to be facetious here. I'm talking about 3 players in NBA history who kind of fit that mold: Steve, Magic, Jason Kidd. And I know there are a lot of, like, John Stockton's a great point guard, and Gary Payton was a great point guard. There are a lot of great point guards. I don't mean this to be a slander against them. But when you talk about making everybody better than whatever the best version of themselves was, those are the 3 guys I think of. And everybody else is kind of like, we're going to run the play, I'll find the right guy who's open, all that stuff, but not on the level of those 3 guys.
Well, all right, so I have 2 reactions to that. And I love Steve. That 2004-05 Suns team might still be my favorite team to watch, at least on offense. I think last year's Warriors, because they did it so well on both ends, might be my favorite team since the Jordan Bulls. But that that 2004-05 Phoenix team might be second. So number one, and you are obviously in Phoenix with him, you may see this as a misconception, and I invite you to say so if you do. But the way I always saw it was, it wasn't necessarily, you know, Steve would make guys better, but the offense was always just him having the ball in his hands and dribbling around until he would find a shot for guys.
Well, here's the yes, in a very simple way you could say that. But the whole thing was, It took me a while on the inside to even figure this out. Like, how do you know he was there? He'd throw passes. He wasn't looking. He never looked. He never saw. He just threw it. And it took me a while to figure out. It's running the offense. If guys are doing what they're supposed to be doing, then there is someone there. Even if I don't know someone's there, I know, wait, I've done this. So if this guy, this defender's here, and this defender's here, and that well, then obviously someone's right there wide and open in the corner, which is crazy. It's basically jumping without a net and knowing that there's a net going to be there. So in a very simplified version of what you're saying is right. Yeah, if you put the ball in the best player's hands and leave it there for the majority of the possession, more often than not, something good is going to happen. But there was a method to the madness, I guess I'm saying. It wasn't just, oh, something's going to happen here. It's him doing things that are going to elicit reactions from the defense. And based on those reactions, these are the options that are available to me. It's almost like a computer figuring out. Like,
yeah, well, absolutely. I agree with that. I just thought, like, you know, if you were someone like Quentin Richardson, for example, all you're kind of doing is just standing on the perimeter and waiting for Steve to, like, get you an open three. Yeah, and that obviously was really, really effective, but it wasn't necessarily the kind of move the basketball. That's why I kind of prefer the Warriors a little bit. Because they're actually moving it from side to side. Everybody's getting a touch.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
So, like, that's what I liked a little bit better about the Warriors.
I'll say, yeah, and absolutely. The Warriors' offense is much more... what's the word I'm looking for?
Egalitarian.
There you go. And because you have so many guys who are great passers. In comparison to that Suns team, 04-05, it was Steve and Joe Johnson. 05-06, which I think might have been more aesthetically pleasing.
When they got D.R.
D.R., yeah. So Boris had a lot of playmaking responsibilities. And then 06-07, when we added Grant Hill. So Grant Hill, Boris, and Steve, it gave you a little bit more.
Now, Grant Hill didn't come on until 08, I think.
Oh, so, I'm sorry, 07, 08. My bad.
Yeah, come on. It's all right. It's okay. You didn't work for them. I worked for them.
But anyways, you know, then you started to see more and more. But at the same time, it's still very Steve dominant. Not like the Warriors. No, that's very clear.
So this is my second point of pushback is... Who won Finals MVP last year?
Andre.
Right, yeah. And so how do you think he managed to score 20 points a game if Steph wasn't making him better? Like, he can't do anything at all one-on-one.
Well, no. There's different types of making him better, right? Like, so when they named Steve Magic and Jason Kidd, they actively made people better. Like,
well, that you're saying that they threw the assist,
Not only that.
That's where I feel Steph's underappreciated in the effect that he has when he's not throwing the direct assist.
Not even coming off screens off the ball, or
getting two on the ball in the pick and roll.
Steph gives you the space to be alive, but just by being there, right? Steph is like, I'm here. And then the defense is like, oh my God. And then in this ensuing chaos, because Steph Curry is on the floor, mind you, he doesn't necessarily have to have the ball, we're going to have all these people sneak into the city of Troy in a Trojan horse. So Andre Iguodala is free to do what he wants to do because there's so much attention to Steph. But although I will point out that Andre's Finals MVP had something to do with his offense, but mostly to do with his defense.
Yeah, no, I agree. Right. But if it hadn't been for him also scoring 20 a game,
you're right.
In addition to what he was doing on LeBron, nobody would have given
him. I'm going to play devil's advocate here, and I'm going to say there were like 7 voters this year, right? I never noticed. I always thought it was like the media core or media mass or whatever. And this year was like the chosen council of 10. I don't even know how they got there.
Well, so isn't it like a bunch of people submit a ballot and then like they pick only 7 of them or something? I forget.
Oh, is that how
when
it
I get a ballot, I'm sure I will know.
I know. I was there. I didn't get a ballot. Zach Lowe was sitting behind me or next to me. He had a ballot. So I just thought because I wasn't serious enough. That's why. But then I realized, no, there was like a handful of people who actually got the ballot. But then the other part of that is, I go back to, and I'm not devaluing that what Steph does doesn't help, but I don't know if it makes you greater than what you already are. It allows you to be the best possible you can be. And again, now we're talking into this weird semantics of, no, he's as best as he can be, but these guys made him even better. But that's, I guess, for lack of a better way to describe it, that's what I'm talking about.
All right, so what else you got? You got anything else that's kind of jumped out at you in the last few days that comes to mind? I got some other stuff to talk about, but I figure if there's anything that you that comes to mind for you, please fire away.
Yeah, I want to ask you, because I haven't seen enough of them. Maybe you have. Carl Anthony Towns, is he really, like, this good just right now, or is it just the schedule, or what's happening here?
Defensively, he is far more advanced than I would have expected. They even have him kind of coming out higher on pick and rolls than you would think for a 7-footer, and he just has the mobility to get up pretty high and still get back and kind of be on the axis and prevent the pass of the roll man. He's blocking some shots. He's, you know, I haven't really seen hardly any mistakes that he's made where guys have penetrated and he just hasn't gotten over. He's kind of failed to execute. You know, he's being protected because he has some good defensive players around him a lot, like when it's KG, when it's Rubio. I mean, Prince, at least, is going to not screw up, even though he's kind of not that great one-on-one anymore. But, yeah, that's what I've been most encouraged by, and they've been defending really well, granted, against, you know, not a murderer's row of offenses. So that's what I've been really liking about him. And then, offensively, they haven't been using his pick-and-pop that much, but he's got some pretty good moves. His touch is great. He's going to be at the point where, think of him as almost like a little bit more athletic and bigger LaMarcus Aldridge. I think he can become that type of player in the post where you can throw it to him with 6 seconds left on the shot clock in the mid post and he can get a decent 40% type of shot. I think that's what he can be ultimately. But he also, they're doing a good job of having him try to beast inside a fair amount as well. So I think he's and also we haven't seen much of this, especially because they have no spacing at all, but he's an unbelievable passer.
Yeah. Yeah, he definitely is. And I'm just, I knew that physically he could do those things defensively, but picking up the nuances of NBA defense for a young guy, that quickly?
Yeah, you would think it's basically, how many young big guys can you think of who right out of the box were good defensively? I mean, I thought it's just, if you have a center who's a rookie, you're just not going to have a good defense. I felt like that was basically like fait accompli, and he has belied that so far.
Absolutely. The other thing is, well, the Ricky Rubio thing is pretty impressive too, right? Like, he's not shooting any better. And the numbers kind of come down from that opening night against the Lakers.
Big surprise there.
but he's shooting. Sometimes these are things that I don't know if the average fan can catch. The fact that Ricky Rubio was shooting is in and of itself like, oh my God, what's happening here? What did you? Someone had their Wheaties today, because this is a guy who literally reached a point where he's like, I just don't want to shoot. Or, you know, shots were reluctant shots. And now he's got some sort of aggression to him. And I think that's helping, right?
Yeah, I think so. I didn't see their latest game against the Bulls, which I kind of wish I had, because I want to know how the Bulls managed to score 4 points in like the last 12 minutes of that game. But yeah, I think just, that's right, simply being able to take it. I mean, nobody wants to give up an open shot.
Right.
And especially because then if you hit one or two, you just feel so guilty. It goes against every instinct that you have as a player to just let a guy shoot and not even like sort of be pretending to close out on him. I agree. It makes a huge difference.
Yeah, man. I hope it doesn't stop, because it's,
and he's so good on defense.
Oh yeah.
Can we,
But that's not new, is it?
Well, it's new to people who think that every European is a terrible defender, especially if you're a guard.
Yeah, that's silly.
It shouldn't be new to anyone who knows what they're talking about.
No, he's always been excellent on that end.
All right. So how much more time? You got like 10 more minutes? You
good for that? Yeah. Let's do it.
All right. So when you were working for the Suns, how did you consume basketball media? Like, who did you read? Did you derive anything of it from the media at all? Or did you think of it as just like a worthless distraction? What were kind of your thoughts? Like, who were you reading? How were you using
it? I'll be honest with you. For me, it was news and information and never opinion.
Yeah.
And that was just me. I can't speak for anybody else, but for me, Mark Stein and Ryan Winhurst and Adrian Wojnarowski and Mark Spears and the newsbreakers, definitely follow them when they write something like this is happening that Orlando's thinking about doing, you know, those are the people I read. And then profiles, any more so I would say with the college guys than NBA guys, but like, because that's the great divider I think in scouting operations is your intel, like how you know this person, not this player, because anyone can pop in the tape and watch and say, oh yeah, he does this, he's not too good when he shoots over his right shoulder, etc. But awful practice habits, kind of a jerk, like these are things that I want to know. And usually, you know, these profile pieces, even though a lot of them are PR'd and shined up, they give you an inkling. So the example I always give is the James Johnson profile piece. I can't remember who wrote it for Sports Illustrated, but that was like, we took this and like used it to investigate all these different avenues, right? Had someone go to Cheyenne, Wyoming and do groundwork there and all like, and so it gives you kind of a peek into what kind of life this person has. And then that allows you to ask more educated questions when you're doing your background research, as opposed to, all right, so tell me again, your name is James Johnson. You say like, that doesn't cut it. I need to know something on a higher level. And so those are the things that I used to consume a lot, like opinion pieces and all. Like, ironically, the stuff that I write that I would not have read when I was with the team.
So you said, all right, we had someone go to Cheyenne, Wyoming, yeah, and do groundwork.
Yeah.
Who is that? Like, and who do they talk to? I mean, they're going in basically to this town, not knowing anyone. Mm-hmm. They just, you got these names of these people, I guess, from the piece. That's really all you're going on. Like, what's the procedure when you get into town?
I'll tell you, we had a guy. I'm not going to say his name or anything like that. he still works in the league.
Was he like a basketball guy or like some like private investigator or something?
Yes. but anyways, so I'll tell you what I did when I was scouting. Because, you know, we always got this list of guys those are your guys that you're supposed to know inside out or whatever. So for me, I would go to the college and I would talk to their academic counselors.
Like, what is the attitude of these people when you go up and talk to them and say, hey, I'm with the Suns, tell me about this guy?
They're very
like, would they be always happy to talk to you?
Yeah, because they don't have, like, the academic counselors don't have any, there's no such thing as, you know, I know, like, we want to believe, like, oh, these people are trying to protect the program at all stops or whatever. But not really. Like, they're just like, look, my job is the guy, you know, passes his classes. Whether he gets drafted or not, it doesn't matter. And so, you know, you talk to them, and it's not necessarily like, okay, and he smokes a lot of weed, right? It's not like that. It's like, how does he treat other people? How does he interact with other people? Like, with his teammates, with his coaches, with the tutors, with you, and things like that. And just trying to get insight on their personality. Sometimes it's their background stuff. What's it like? What's his family life like? What was it like before he got here? And again, because they've worked with these people, they know, and they can speak on a more intelligent level than you know, sometimes even the coaches, because the coaches really don't get to know their guys on that level. Same thing with like strength and conditioning coaches. I don't know what it is about that job that makes you incredibly frank. I know it to be true from the trainers that we had at the Suns. They just don't pull punches. How is he? He's lazy. We got to twist his arm to get in here. Like, they'll put it right out there. And so those are the kind of people I would talk to when I was trying to figure out and get to know more. Then, you know, you talk to the AAU coaches. You talk to people they played with. That's why I say it's mostly for college, because the NBA, once you play in the NBA, now you start building an official permanent record. And so before we traded for Jason Richardson, we talked to Matt Barnes and asked him, what's Jason like? And Matt was like, this guy's the greatest teammate ever. And he was right. Jason was a great teammate. You know, so you can do these kind of, I'm sure the Spurs, before they signed Boris Diaw, they had like a very long conversation with Tony. It's like, yo, is this guy, we know he's a smart player. What's his rep? And Tony probably told him, look, if you respect him and keep him challenged, he's going to be engaged. And again, that turned out to be great. So, but basically what I'm saying is, once you play in the league and play with people and play for coaches, like, now we start to get to know who you are. and I could find out about you from just conversations with people. As opposed to college, where you're, international, or whatever, you're still somewhat of an unknown. And so now I have to go and I have to dig beyond people directly with you, meaning obviously your head coach, because the head coach of a college program will always tell you nothing unless the person is awful, and in which case you probably don't want him anyway.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, do you ever have people you go and say, hey, I'm from the Suns, tell me about this guy, and they're like, no.
No, but what they do is they just give you nothing. So there was a school where I was trying to, should I say this? No, guys. There's an NBA player now who's a good NBA player. Let me put this way. I'll draw a picture, paint a picture for you, and then you can draw your conclusions from there. He's a pretty good NBA player. He went to college in this country. He's not from this country. And when I went to go inquire about him, they literally did not give me anything. Like, they didn't say no. They would just say, oh, he's fine. Like, everything. And, you try to ask open-ended questions, no yes or no stuff, but they gave me absolutely nothing. Nothing. And he's a good player. He's a good guy. So I guess there was no need for them to do that. But some colleges are just very close rank like that.
Yeah, I guess it's always just a sliding scale when you talk to people, too, right? Like, if they're absolutely gushing about how awesome he is versus, yeah, he's a good guy, blah, blah. Like, that's probably, good guy, blah, blah, probably means,
that's the NBA. Well, that's the NBA thing for, if you're trying to work in this league. Right, not for players. I don't know if I've had this conversation with you. I think I have. But, the whole idea of, so-and-so is trying to get in, he wants a player development job. And so, where was he last? Oh, he was in, he's with the Anaheim Amigos last. Okay. My guy Nate is over there with Anaheim. I was like, yo, Nate, you guys had, John? What was he like? Oh, he's okay. That means he's awful. Because the whole NBA doublespeak is, if you're good, I am going to oh my God, this guy's amazing. You gotta hire this guy. That's my dude. He'll do anything. Because the whole idea is that you're good. And so if they hire you and you do a good job for them, now they owe me a favor. Meanwhile,
and it's also just your reputation, yeah, as well,
exactly.
Right? Like part of your currency of working in the league is actually being right about things, whether it's people, whether it's players, whatever. I mean, I think whenever you're having a conversation like that, you're always kind of being judged
and guilty
on whether you're right or not. So yeah, I mean, someone could be your friend, but. Going to say that they're amazing,
exactly,
and they're not.
Exactly, because again, it's the whole guilty by association. I run in this crowd. What's your crowd? My crowd is all the smart people. So for me, there's a reason why I beat my drum really hard. Is that Nicky Wren was my insert. Like, as part of that, I'm actually piggybacking on him, saying, look, this is what our program produced. But again, if you look at our program, who do we produce? David Griffin, Steve Kerr, Nicky Wren, me, Alvin, it's a long list of people who are doing very well for themselves, based on what we had going, and this very small front office. And so, yeah, that's a big part of it, is this idea that my currency is, look at who I know, who I work with. This is the reputation we bring to the table. When you hire an Amin sealed and approved candidate, you are getting this with it, this tradition of excellence.
So now that you are in the media, and you said you would never have read the stuff that you write now,
mm-hmm.
Do you have kind of a higher opinion of the media than you did back when you were working for a team?
Yes and no.
Maybe
yes
certain
no.
Very small elements,
yes and no.
Of the media?
Yes and no. There are first of all, I think there are more smart people writing about the game smartly now than there were when I was working for the team.
That's probably true. Yeah, I mean, it was kind of, back then it was kind of Hollinger and maybe a few team bloggers,
right,
and stuff, and there wasn't as much.
Yeah, so that's part of it. It's just a
Peldon, I guess, was writing back then too.
Oh no, he was working when I was working. I think he was working. Maybe
he was doing Basketball Prospectus back then.
Was he? I thought he was. Working.
Yeah,
I thought he was with Indiana. But anyways,
but he was writing and doing Indiana.
Oh, well.
That's what it was.
Yeah. But anyways, the point is, part of it is just we have more smart material out. The other part of it, I think, is, and this is going to sound really egotistical, what we were doing was so ahead of the curve. There's nothing I think I could have read that would have made us smart about what we were doing. Because everybody was writing, oh,
yeah, jump shooting yeah, team, not, don't defend, yeah. all that bullshit.
So, exactly.
Yeah.
So for us, it was just kind of like, I'm not going to listen to people who are telling me things that because they're not on our level, really.
Yeah. And whereas, yeah, like, oh, they can't defend. Well, actually, you know, we're like 14th in defense.
Yeah.
By points per possession. Calm down. You know?
So fast forward now, I think there's two conflicting things pulling. On the one hand, I think, you know, people have all caught up to the style of play. So if you're not playing that style of play without a serious strategic bent to it, meaning like if Tony Allen was a 40% three-point shooter, I don't think Memphis would be in the hot water it's in. I think they could survive playing the way they play, but because he's not, like basically your entire premise is that we're going to actually respect Tony Allen on the court as an opposing defense. And so that's why Memphis is slowly falling apart now, because everyone knows, like, oh, why are we pretending like we have to play like it's 1994 when we play them? I'm just going to play my style and they won't be able to keep up. So that's part of it, right? So you're pretty far behind on the times if you're still trying to figure out this, the way the game should be played right now based on the rules and the way the players are developing. But at the same time, I think teams now have more information available to them than was – like in the past, the raw data was there and the media and the people on the outside were using it better than the teams were, right? Because teams were still – you know, I'm talking about far past, before people knew about points per possession. You know, we were like, why are we doing it this way? We could do it that way, you know. Now, because of the virtue of the sport view data, it is proprietary. Teams' knowledge about things is a lot more advanced than most of us, other than the few media people.
Is that stuff really making that big of a difference?
I think for the smart teams, yeah.
Like, what do you think they're getting? And this is obviously speculation, because I honestly, you know, haven't been able to get that many people to talk to me about this. But like, and maybe you have, and you'll keep that to yourself. But it's like, what are they getting? Just, I mean, you know, maybe we don't know what the answers to those questions are, but what questions are they getting answered that is just not in the public sphere?
They're getting stuff on the margins, really. It's not like cataclysmic, like, oh, if I put him here, then it all. Oh, but it's like little things like when we're guarding a side pick and roll, you're here. I want you to be here. And that's stuff that it used to be a coach's gut or intuition was telling you, oh, you're too far over, or you lift your left, or, you know, you left too soon or whatever. Now we have actual raw data like, oh, when you do it this way, we do it, this happens. When we do it this way, this happens.
So it's sort of like, all right, we're going to take an example of all side pick and rolls where we brought the guy all the way over to the nail versus on the weak side versus when we didn't. And let's see what the difference in the result is league wide. Right. And now we're gonna do this every time based on like what it is,
or
like, that kind of like very granular
or
stuff.
Even more granular than that, like you're supposed to be on the nail, but every time you went past the nail, every time you kind of were more elbow than nail, now what's happening, you know, like things like that. And then you know, obviously I'm sure we can draw like something like David Lee. What David Lee was doing 5 years ago, cannibalizing and all that stuff. Now we can actually show it, right? We can show it with a lot less fuzziness. Like, oh, no. This guy has numbers because he is just exists for his numbers. They don't actually help us. They're empty calories. And so these are all things now we can now bring to the table with. Here's, I told you so. I told you playing Channing Frye and Amari Stoudemire at the same time for a long time is a bad idea, even though they're great offensively. But in spurts, you can still get away with it. You know, things like that, you can now bring to the table and unequivocally say, see, I told you so. And those are the little things in the margins. The best teams to me are the ones that are integrating it, not allowing it to dictate, not dismissing it when it doesn't jibe with what you feel, but having a really meaningful hybrid relationship between what the coach feels and what the numbers say.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And there's definitely so many questions that you would love to just to answer with that data if you really had access to it. But I do agree. I mean, I don't think it's hard for me to think that, like, if you have access to the sport view, you're going to think, all right, this guy is actually really good when everyone else thinks he's just not a good player. Like, it doesn't seem like it would be that extreme.
No,
you know, based on what you can see just watching on
right, TV. And that's the funny thing about a lot of this sport view, that is a lot of it does actually confirm, oh, you guys were doing it the right way. Or things like where guys should be when the shot goes up. Where we want our guys to be to have the best chance of an offensive rebound or the best chance of a defensive rebound.
That's a really good one, actually. Like, I remember in high school, my coach was like, all right, do you have to get to, like, 45-degree angle off the glass right. to get an offensive rebound? Like, how the hell do you know that? So now you actually can know exactly where you should be, especially when you shoot from a certain area on the court or something like that, too. You know where to get to. But
at the same time, I want to point out, again, it's the margins. This is not going to overcome you not having LeBron James on your team if you're the Brooklyn Nets or something like that. Like, it doesn't matter how smart you are. At some point, it comes down to the little pixelated characters on your screen going out and doing what they're supposed to do.
All right. Well, with that inescapable truth, I should let you go. I guess this was good for you, though. You stopped coughing like halfway through. I think maybe like this is actually helpful for you. You got anything to plug before you go?
Absolutely. Oh, you know what? I'm going to be on Levitard Radio Show on Thursday. And I'm going to be on Highly Questionable on that same day. So Thursday is a good 5 hours of Amin coverage, or four and a half hours, whatever it is.
All right. I'm glad we could get your voice back in shape. So that's not just basketball, right? That's just basically everything.
Yeah, that's everything. But they usually bring me on because I am the quote-unquote basketball expert. So there will be a lot of basketball talk, I know, on the radio show. And then on Highly Questionable, it's actually probably the best day to be on. Basketball wise, because football hasn't happened yet, right? It's the Thursday night game. I'm on Thursday during the day. And then we're the day after Wednesday's ESPN doubleheader, which is also Wednesday, has like 8 zillion games. So there's going to be a lot of basketball fodder, I imagine, to talk about on Highly Questionable.
Well, so how do you even, the non basketball stuff, you just like come up with an opinion? I mean, I guess, like, if you're one of these guys who does all the sports, it's like, it's impossible to have, like, that much of a depth of an opinion anyway. You're probably just as qualified as anyone else.
Pretty much, yeah. So, you know, they all bring something different, right? Everyone has, you know, when Michael Smith, for instance, used to be on Around the Horn, Michael Smith used to actually cover the Patriots. He'd cover the NFL. So, or Adande when he's on. Like, Adande's basketball knowledge is going to be deeper than anybody else's on that panel. But at the same time, is Adande as versed on NFL as Michael Smith was? Probably not, you know, and that's just, you know, that's the beauty of having a multi-billion dollar corporation with all these great people, that I don't have to be an expert on football. I can just play my part and then be intelligent enough to carry conversation about the other stuff. And that's where I'm at. So especially when baseball's over, by the way, it's a lot easier to do that because baseball is truly I'm on a thin line there. But again, the other nice thing about Levitard, both his radio show and his TV show, is it's a very lighthearted show. And so it is possible for me with a baseline level of knowledge to make a reasonably astute/funny joke about this news story. And it's only for like 30 seconds before we move on to the next one anyway.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, thanks so much for coming on. What's your Twitter handle?
@AminESPN. It is the easiest thing you can ever come up with. Unless you can't spell my name, which is AMIN.
All right. If you want to follow me on Twitter, that is NateDuncanNBA. Also, my Facebook page is a good place to keep up with my writing. That is also NateDuncanNBA, and of course, supporting the show, if you want to give us a review or rating on iTunes, that's really appreciated. Using one of our awesome sponsors, DraftKings or SeatGeek, using that cap space code to get a great deal to get started and use some awesome products, that supports the show as well. Thanks again to Amin for coming on, and we'll talk to you all next time.